Rick Purcell, who's one of a few Cornell Cooperative Extension educators specializing in Greene and Columbia counties. He has a particular interest in horticultural issues, obviously, and we welcome him to our broadcast along with Audrey.
Thank you.
Okay, so you're here because we're about, I'm not going to say we're all about to die, but there are some things that are going on. I mean, one of the issues living in a, you know, basically quasi-rural, I guess, an environment in upstate New York is that you're susceptible to various things coming down the pike. And, I mean, New York, obviously, a state that's highly reliant on forestry and agriculture. The Cornell Cooperative Extension Statewide Invasive Species Education Program, or CCEISP, was created in late 2010. And to kind of spearhead response to some of these issues that are coming up, which we will talk about, can you give us a little background?
Correct.
On what?
I mean, if we go back just even into the late part of the 20th century, Bill Clinton, I think, was the first one to pass a law basically recognizing the fact that invasive species were causing an enormous amount of problems in our country. And there's lots of different kinds of invasive species. And they were starting to put a number on what it actually cost us. And it's somewhere in the area of about $140 billion a year. So, it's been something that we really need to get a handle on for a long time. We've been a little slow, perhaps, to getting that going, but we understand now that we really need to concentrate on things either preventing them from getting here or attacking them right away when they first get here, because we actually have a pretty good shot to get rid of them if we do it quickly. Once they're established, it's much more difficult to do anything about it. So trying to get the awareness up out in the community so that we can actually have a lot of eyes out there looking for things, and so that when we do see things early enough and we can actually make a quick response to it, we actually have a pretty good shot of getting rid of it and preventing it. Because, you know, we already have a lot of big problems, but, you don't know. The next one could be the biggest. So we'd like to have something in place now that would be a little more effective than what we've been doing for the last few decades.
Now, to bring Audrey in for a moment. So, CRISP, what is this organization? How are you working in partnership with Rick?
Well, CRISP is the Catskill Regional Invasive Species Partnership, and it is an organization that is part of 8 PRISMs in New York State. And it covers the Catskill region, and it's working to increase awareness and combat invasive species in the Catskill region. I actually have been working with CRISP in communities in Ulster and Greene County, focusing on the emerald ash borer, which is an invasive beetle from Asia that kills ash trees and was recently discovered here in New York State. And actually, in 2010, the largest population in the state was discovered in Saugerties. So we're doing a lot of work in communities trying to build awareness about emerald ash borer.
Right. And so I understand there are 900 million, approximately, ash trees in New York.
In New York State, correct.
And how bad is the potential damage from this pest?
Most of the entomologists at Cornell and in other universities around the country are feeling pretty hopeless about the fact that we won't be able to do anything to prevent this from happening. We probably won't be able to get anything in place in time, at least in New York, and maybe not everywhere else as well. So we're expecting we may lose our ash, pardon the expression, in New York, due to this little insect. But, you know, if you actually look at the adult insect, it's about a half inch long. It doesn't look particularly nasty, but it actually takes out these perfectly healthy trees.
And so where it has already come into the states, has there been absolute devastation?
Oh, definitely. Out in the Midwest, there are places where the ash really no longer exist, and they've basically wiped out. And in a lot of places in this country, when the elms were blighted back about 50, 60 years ago, a lot of those street trees were replaced with ash. Huh. So now we have, you know, the same kind of scenario again, where, you know, little small communities where all these trees, and once they do decline, and once they are killed by this insect, they really don't stand up very long on their own. So they become a real hazard to health and safety.
Right. So it's not just it's not just losing them. It's like how you lose them that could cause perhaps damage and even, and death.
So our point is really to try to get awareness up, because when it does move into your particular neighborhood, you're going to really need to be prepared. You're going to need to look around your house and see if you have ash that are leaning over the house or leaning over wires. And those kinds of things all along the road inside the town.
Well, just briefly, as someone who is not necessarily native to this area and not particularly blessed with an ability to tell one tree from another, one, how do you know that you have an ash tree?
Well, that's part of the education process. We really have to teach people how to ID ash trees. And it's not that difficult. It's not something we can really do on the radio, so to speak. But, in person, it's usually pretty easy to convince people what ash look like between the bark, the leaves, the branching, all the different things that enable you to identify an ash tree.
So taking that into consideration, through the CCE or through the CCE, ISP, and or CRISP, what do you do to bring people to have this education come to play? I mean, do you send people out to the field? Are there town meetings? Do you set up is the website? Are there videos?
All of the above, actually. About a week and a half ago, we did a program up at the Mountaintop Arboretum up in Tannersville, which happens to be in Tannersville, happens to be a very rich area for ash. And it's a beautiful arboretum. I don't know if anybody's been there in Tannersville, but it's a great place to visit. And they have this wonderful little trail area that they opened up just within the last few years. And it's just surrounded by huge, healthy ash. So we did a program up there a week and a half ago to basically get the public in to learn how to ID the ash. And actually, we went around and tagged each one of the ash trees in this area that would be a threat once the borer does get into town. And it's not that far down the road from Tannersville to where Saugerties were, and it's also in Greene County as well. Mm. And the truth of it is, we don't really know all the places where it is. It's not easy to identify. It's rather difficult. So it could be in quite a few other places that we don't yet know.
Wow.
So we want people to be aware to start paying attention to the signs that they should look for, and then so hopefully we can actually get there and get information out to people before trees start falling and things like that start to happen.
And with CRISP, through some of the programs we've been doing with the Emerald Ash Borer Community Support Project, we've been outreaching to municipalities and trying to inform highway departments and town supervisors about the issue and get everybody trying to get on the idea of trying to make a plan and coming up with some ideas about how you might deal with the Emerald Ash Borer even prior to the infestation coming into your town. Because the best way you can mitigate, some of the hazardous impacts of the beetle is to plan for it and take actions while there still is some time.
And so what might some of these mitigating factors
take Tannersville as an example. They have, I think in the inventory they did of Tannersville, they have about 76 street trees in Tannersville. So consider the expense when the borer does get to town. Consider the expense of removing all those trees if that's what would have to happen all in one time period. It would probably be better to plan way ahead. And even if, it takes 5 to 10 years for it to get here, starting the plan now, so determining which trees really are the most hazardous, which ones probably should be taken out, maybe which ones can be, and by the way, there are pesticides that can keep these trees healthy and alive. It just requires continual pesticides to do that. So
I'm assuming that when you're talking about pesticides, you're going to run into a coterie of people who are somewhat hands off with that too.
That's true, but we're talking about injections basically, so we're not talking about something that's going to be loose in the environment. It's not going to get into the water or anything like that. We're talking about injecting particular trees. And actually, there's a lot of research to say that maybe preventing some of them from dying right away and actually having a plan will save you a lot of money, ultimately. They've already learned these lessons out in the Midwest. A lot of towns were bankrupt when the ash borer got to town. So we'd like to get things in place before that happens so people can start a plan now, both in the community and maybe, it's not just that you, around your own property and around your own home, but if you have any, input into your community, it would help to maybe do a little talking there as well to get people on board so they understand when this actually happens, and it's going to happen, it's going to be a serious problem that we're all going to have to deal with. So this is just the beginning of a conversation that people are going to hear for quite a few years, and we don't expect it's going to go away. They've already heard things like Asian longhorn beetle. You know, everybody's familiar with that in Chicago and in New York. There's a little more hope associated with the Asian longhorn beetle. But with the emerald ash borer, we're not really that hopeful. So people are really going to have to learn about this. And it's, you know, it's a good way to get awareness up to a lot of other invasives as well. Just when people start realizing how important this stuff is and how we really need to act quickly when these things come into town.
Yes. Well, that's by way of segue. But first, I'm Ron Diamonstein, and I'm talking with Rick Burstell from the Cornell Cooperative Extension, and Audrey Kropp from CRISP, dealing with invasive species here in our part of New York State, here at WGXC 90.7 FM. The time is 5:30. So some other things I've noticed on the website, which we'll also get to in terms of the resource of the websites, was feral swine, which, I mean, I only laugh because it's just...
It gets a laugh.
We're turning away. I mean, you're talking about, you know, bugs and you know, invasive plant species and all, and then you just have, you know, you're talking about wild pigs running amok.
It does seem strange. And most people do chuckle when we say it. Most people think it's a wonderful thing because everybody loves pork. And
it's the revenge of pork.
Yes. But actually, they can be quite devastating to the forest and to a lot of other things. And quite threatening, and they are a big problem. And once they're out there in the wild, it's really very difficult to get them. So it is a big problem. And I think even our families could be at risk, and our pets, and so forth.
Well, I mean, disease carrying, I would assume, as well.
So yeah, they are a problem. It is, like I say, if you actually look at the website, there's quite a bit of information on the website about feral swine, and it is actually a serious problem. And even though we do chuckle because it does sound like a great way to get a pulled pork sandwich or something along those lines, but it's not really the same kind of thing. These are generally swine that have been brought into the country for different reasons, sometimes for hunting and things like that, that escape and start up basically communities out there in the forest, and very devastating, actually.
So what are some of – now, this is not something necessarily that, like, let's say here in Catskill proper where we're broadcasting, but I'm assuming perhaps as you go further out into Greene County, are you looking for evidence of groupings, or are they solitary?
We haven't really heard any Greene County sightings.
Okay.
At least I haven't.
Okay,
not
here yet.
Further down in the state, we've heard some, and some other places in the state where they actually are having issues with this. And there's also a lot of dialogue going on about it. People who are sort of in the business of hunting these kinds of things are pretty adamant about wanting to continue what they're doing, and if they could just use maybe domestic pigs, maybe we wouldn't be having such a big issue.
Well, I mean, but it just occurs to me, well, if you've brought them in to hunt and some of them have escaped, wouldn't it be beholden on you as the hunter to actually really use your hunting skills and go out and get them?
You would think so. But
these, instead of bringing more in?
You know, they're very intelligent animals.
Yeah.
I think it's a lot different than hunting deer. It's a lot different. And when they know somebody's out to get them, they're very good at being scattered and gone. So they're a tough one, to be honest with you. And I don't know how that one's going to play out ultimately. Hopefully, we'll be able to get a handle on it. Some of the other ones, like I say, certain ones seem to be more serious than others. I mean, if you look around, there's plenty of invasives that are already in the area, things like barberry, multiflora rose, Japanese knotweeds.
And now these are
plants. Invasive that basically displace native plants, and because they generally grow quicker, taller, faster, and they kind of shade things out and basically take over areas and eliminate native species, which ends up affecting the entire food chain.
So
it's quite an issue. And if you Japanese knotweed's been in the area for probably 100 years or something, so it's kind of a thing that we're probably not going to get a handle on that one. But there's probably new things that are going to arrive all the time, and you hear them on the news, things in the water bodies and different places. you know, we really need to attack very quickly and really, you know, respond to these things quickly because it costs all of us in the long run. And it also degrades our environment and our forests and everything else.
So, yes, we'll continue along this sort of greatest hits of somewhat bad news. But, well, it's not really bad news, but I mean, it's just stuff to be concerned about. I mean, you know, you just, there's this sort of sense that, like, I grew up in New York City, if I'm going to be personal for a second. And, you know, growing up there, it was, you kind of had to worry about things in New York, you know, and then you think, well, the big bad city, if only we could be out in the blissful countryside. And lo and behold, there are other predators here. And one in particular that you have been somewhat in the forefront of trying to educate people about are tick-borne diseases.
Yep.
Obviously, Lyme disease is, you know, wins pride of place and, you know, the gold medal, as it were, for being something that's pretty well known through people. But can you talk a little bit about how things were happening with various tick-borne diseases season?
When we're talking about invasives, you know, the tick and the diseases themselves aren't really on the same list with these other invasives. But obviously, you know, they don't come from Asia. They actually come from the southern part of the U.S. These diseases actually come from lots of places. A lot of them are kind of global. But the reality here is, and I'm sure everybody heard this past spring, they were predicting a really bad summer. They were saying this would be the worst Lyme disease year we've ever had. And as it turned out, it was extremely hot and dry this summer. And the worst thing that could ever happen to a tick is hot and dry. So the tick population was very quiet all summer. So everybody's sort of forgotten about the ticks, I think, but they're back now, big time. And you know, when you consider one engorged tick gives birth to about 2,800 little eggs, it doesn't take very long for the population to get back.
Yeah.
And there's about, we're talking about at least four diseases inside of a deer tick now. So the potential, when you get bit now, you can actually get co-infections with more than Lyme. You can be hospitalized very easily. And actually, some of these newer diseases can actually be fatal, too. So there's something that you really need to react to quickly and not just linger. You need to get to a physician right away. And usually what I tell people about ticks, it usually has to do with level of engorgement. If that tick is a little bigger once it leaves your body than it was when it got on your body, the potential is there that you could have picked up something, because that tick, before it fed on you, a summer tick, has already fed on something else. And more likely than not, it would be a rodent or a bird. And that's how it picks up these these other problems and then brings it to us. And there's been a lot of people in the Hudson Valley. I mean, of all the places you could go in the country, I think the Hudson Valley is the hotbed area now for Lyme disease and these other tick-borne diseases. People really need to pay attention. When you're outside and you go into natural areas, you really need to check yourself. That's the most effective thing you could do. If you can get those ticks off you every day, your chances of getting sick are very low.
Right. I mean, I would think as well, going into fall and early winter, one advantage is that most people would be sort of wearing long sleeve clothing. So you're at least, it's not as if you're just brazenly walking through the woods in shorts and sandals.
Right. The worst time is basically from May through August. That's usually the worst time, because those are the summer deer ticks, which are the nymphal stage, which are very, very small. Everybody's heard how small deer ticks are. Well, it's the summer tick we're talking about. And they're very easy to miss. I mean, they are really small, like the period at the end of the sentence, so to speak.
Right.
This time of year, right now, the adults are showing up again. But the nymphs are still out there as well. So you can actually, you know, come in. I notice I monitor my cats, and they actually do go out. So I get to see all the different stages of ticks. And I live in a very tick-borne area. I live very, very, a lot of deer population, a lot of oak trees, a lot of rodents, things like that. So I get a pretty good handle on what's going on, at least around my house. And that gives me a sort of an idea of what's going on around the county.
Right, right. So just briefly, as we wrap up, how would people get involved in educating themselves and acquiring information, not only simply for ticks, but basically the Emerald Ash Borer, which was a prime focus of what we're talking about.
Right. Yeah. There's actually some great web resources, and if they're interested in getting involved, and if a community is interested in perhaps in inventorying their ash trees, they could get some assistance from CRISP. And they can reach CRISP online at CatskillInvasives.com. And
obviously
another,
one word. Yeah.
Yes. CatskillInvasives.com, one word. And if they're if you're interested in learning more about the invasive species in New York State, there's an excellent website, and that is nyis.info.
Info.
Dot info. And those two are great resources. And if they're, you know, like we said, we encourage people to learn more. That's one of the best ways you can start, is to educate yourself and move from there.
And you know, if you don't remember the website, just Google something like New York invasive species, and all of these sites will come up.
They do,
and
yes.
And if you click on them, you will see exactly what we're talking about. A lot of serious stuff going on. Everybody really needs to get up to date on this stuff so we can actually have an effect to cut it back. And we need more eyes out there in the world helping us out.
Well, I hope this little broadcast, and hopefully it'll be archived up on the WGXC website as well, and it'll provide another aspect of information for people to stay on top of this. Audrey Kropp from the organization CRISP, Rick Burstell, educator from the Cornell Cooperative Extension for Queen and Columbia Counties. They've been my guest here on the Wednesday afternoon show. I'm Ron Diamonstein. I want to thank them both for joining.
I thank you.
Having us.
I thank you.
Yes,
be safe out there, please.
Yeah, really. All right, and so we'll be going to some music. Free Speech, Al Jazeera News in English will be coming up at 6. Free Speech Radio News at 6:30. How about some Led Zeppelin at WGXC?